On this week's show, discussing risky data with Chris Green from NFP. In this week's news, Meta, failure, climate measurements, and more.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right, we're back, and I think Nathan dressed up for the show today. Nathan, you're looking a little high-vis there.
I am having so much fun being a GC right now. I just am soaking it all up, putting my vest back on, even though residential, it's pretty rare to see the vests and the hard hats, but, you know, trying to set a new standard here.
Trying to get that PPE on the job site at home, huh?
Yes, waiting for the inspector to show up, so hopefully after the recording here, but we'll see.
Yeah. You truly are GCing. You're waiting for inspectors. You have your high vis on. Although I was out riding my bike and I came across a house being built for the first time ever. Big sign out front. This is a safe job site. No one comes on without checking in, and a list of the PPE you had to have. I was like, way to go. I like that. You don't see that in residential construction nearly as much. So way to show it off and suffer. We had a long conversation yesterday about what it's like to be a GC, didn't we?
Oh, yes. Shared pains.
Shared pains. And we have Chris Green joining us this morning. Chris, how you doing, man?
Good, good. How are you? Thanks, Jeff, and thanks, Nathan. I should have joined the construction party here and got my hard hat, but representing insurance today, so we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, well, you don't need to wear the hard hat. You just got to make sure you got that, you know, something out there watching them that they're wearing those hard hats. So we'll get into a little bit more about what Chris does, because I think y'all are going to dig this one. Mm-hmm. Before we do, we got to pause for the cause.
For the last 20 plus years, I've been talking about this mind-body connection and working a lot on focusing on things like stress and nutrition and sleep and exercise and how that affects performance and how that affects longevity. We've been focusing on this peak level of mental, physical, and emotional performance. Construction in general is a highly stressful environment, and you see the stress. And you always get the "I'm fine" answer, but I always try to dig a little deeper, because people say, you know, "I haven't been sleeping great, and I'm really eating crappy food, and I feel anxious, I feel depressed, I feel," you know, we'll start to really get into those conversations and figure out what's going on.
Those are the critical things people need it's the little steps, right? You're not here to replace a mental health diagnosis, right? You're here, but there's some resources you've got that can help people kind of figure out if, hey, they might be headed down towards that one.
Right, exactly. Barring some mental health diagnosis, or if you think you have a mental health diagnosis, please go seek someone out and get that help and that diagnosis. But barring just a diagnosis, or you're really struggling or having suicidal thoughts, you know, this isn't going to help you probably. But to check in and see where am I now and how do I keep from going down that rabbit hole, there's some great resources. And if you go to brentdarnell.com/resources, first, there's an emotional intelligence and physical symptom survey test. So we get your emotional profile and we get your physical profile based on physical symptoms, and we tell how your body's working. And then we can correlate those two. And if you're experiencing burnout, it will show up in probably both of those evaluations. It's free. You just download it and do it. And just so see where you are. And if burnout's the top two or three that pop up and show up there, I would pay attention and start to really look at what are you doing with stress and nutrition and sleep and exercise and daily reflection and those kinds of things that we know we need to do to keep us healthy and keep us sane and keep us on track.
You've got to check in with where you are. You've got to work on balancing. It's not about the diagnosis. It's about preventing people from getting too far down the road. Like most of our construction folks that listen in, they take care of their cars. They keep them up to date. You know, this is no different. You've got to put in the maintenance on the body, on the mind, because you're racing this car around the track, right? We're not going to change that we're a bunch of race cars out there, but we can change that we do the right maintenance, take the right time, and and really check in.
One more resource in there. It's the Tough Guy Survival Kit, Guy Being Gender Neutral. It's specifically written geared toward more field folks, but there's a really great chapter on stress management and peak performance in there. And it talks about meditation techniques and mindfulness techniques and breathing techniques.
Wow, those are all great resources. If you didn't hear that before, it's brentdarnell.com. That's brentdarnell.com/resources. Check them out. They're there for free. Brent, thanks for joining us on this Pause for the Cause. All right. Remember, we're back on YouTube. Check us out. Lots of you have been signing up and hitting that subscribe button, so I'm really excited with y'all. Maybe next week I'll even read a name off as we head into the end of construction conference season. But thanks for hitting that button. Make sure you get out there. We're youtube.com/@thecontechcrew. At the Contech Crew, we focus on technology that solves industry problems, and we've always believed in our sponsors, so much so that I went to work for one of them. So today, I want to talk to you about Joint. Every construction project is a unique prototype, and it's actually shaped by thousands of decisions that impact the owner's business case, design, and the budget. Today, the communication driving these decisions is disjointed across all the stakeholders. Work happens in email, Excel, estimating, resulting in delays, waiting for decisions, waiting for access to information, and sometimes that information is outdated and incomplete. Managing the expectations of the team and keeping the project moving forward is a constant challenge, and a lot of times drives skepticism amongst the contributors. Join empowers general contractors to build with confidence and maximize the potential of every project by connecting these owners through new workflows that fit into your existing processes. We bring design teams and trade partners into a single platform. There's transparency and collaboration in the decision making, which builds trust and sets projects up for success. You might be asking yourself, do you need another tool? Well, let me tell you, Join fits in seamlessly with your processes and your other tools. In fact, we're here to help those other tools. Regardless of your estimating system or your project management process, Join will be a valuable added resource without disrupting those other systems and your teams. Check out Join, the collaborative project delivery platform for the built environment. Learn more at join.build. All right, we're back. I've got Chris Green, and I'm just excited. Like, I'm kind of enamored with titles. Obviously, people understand I have an interesting one, but Chris's is pretty cool. VP of Strategy and Analytics. Okay, but it's VP Strategy, Analytics, and Knowledge for NFP. So tell me a little bit about Chris before we get into the keeper of the knowledge and where we're going to go with it. I'm excited to have you on today.
Sure. Sounds good. Thanks, Jeff. I'll start, you know, way back when I was going to school, I was always enamored with technology. I was always the tech guy. I loved computers, you know, building computers, software, technology, anything innovative. Just that was my passion. That was what I had, a lot of fun playing with every single day, right? So ended up going to school for business and data science. And got a minor in IT. So didn't really know where I wanted to take that, but I figured, hey, let's try to look at a couple different industries. You know, construction was always interesting for me. And I figured, you know, how can I really apply like this passion for innovation into something that needs it, right? So got my first job at Aon and kind of fell into really quickly this place where I could leverage the skills I learned in school around data management, data science, and also follow my passion for technology, right? Because there was almost like this boom of construction tech at the time. This was nearly about 10 years ago. And one of my mentors, David Bocott, I walked into his office and I was like, hey, here's some of my thoughts, you know, around how we could, you know, digitize this space. I looked around, looked for problems to solve and realized, yeah, there's a lot of automation that we could have here. So we started that journey right then and there. We ran with a technology assessment panel because we realized, hey, you know, we're brokers. We know what's going wrong with the industry through our claims data, right, for our clients. So I kind of figured let's hit this head on, and we went down the path. We ran the tech assessment panel for like 8 years. And then now I've just joined NFP alongside David Volkov as well. And we're really trying to hit hard with our clients. How can you change the way you're doing things now to leverage innovation and technology and figure out how insurance fits into that?
And we're seeing this push. And that's why I was really excited to have you on and talk about that, because it does seem like those around us are starting to understand how technology can help all of us. So how are your clients and how are you approaching clients with that idea? I mean, are you, you know, we've talked about a bunch of different ways you can approach them. So how are you approaching them and what's the reception been like?
So in the past, I would say 3 years or so, it's been, clients have been a lot more receptive to this. Like our clients, we tend to focus on the larger GCs across North America and some of the larger projects, but they tend to be a little bit more sophisticated and they have the budgets to try out and test and pilot different technologies. There was always a bigger question mark with like the mid-sized players to say, hey, how do we use this? How do we scale it down to what we do? And we did kind of focus on that a little bit too, but it's changing at first, you know, like 10 years ago, people just had this big question mark, but they're almost in awe. Like you walk into any of these tech conferences a while back and I was in awe. I remember walking into my first ENR Future Tech conference and looking up on screen and I saw some of the cool stuff they're doing. And I was just amazed. I was like, a lot of that stuff was in the concept phase back then. But now I think companies have really refined themselves and the ones that have stuck around really have something to prove and can actually have a huge change in the way contractors are operating to optimize health and safety and risk and operations. So I think now that people are starting to figure out and kind of fine tune how to use, what to use and how it all kind of comes together, whether they have it figured out or not, I think they at least know what the future could look like and they're not really suffering from tech exhaustion anymore, but they're trying to figure out different recipes to say, hey, if I bring these things together holistically, I've seen some good promises and some good insights from it. So it's definitely changing in the last few years where people are saying, hey, I'm getting excited again to see what I can do with the data and with the tech.
It's interesting because there is that sine curve. Nathan, looks like you got a question.
I mean, certainly construction is an industry that struggles with a culture of innovation that, you know, they want it to work, but they don't necessarily want to like do the work that it takes to get it there. And I have to imagine risk and insurance is maybe not the most progressive, or correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe that's been your experience, but you know, like as someone that is so forward thinking, how have you been able to combat those that are naysayers or skeptics or are facing that tech exhaustion? How have you been able to keep up the passion?
In the first half of my career, it's really just been around educating people of what's out there, right? So I'm not a sales guy, but when I go and present around construction technology, it's more about the passion and educating on what's out there, right? So as brokers, we do have to remain agnostic with the techs for our clients to be trusted advisors. So we're in this kind of cool seat that says, hey, we're not going to say you have to use this or we're getting the biggest referral from this company. We can say, this is what our tech assessment panel has vetted. And these are the options that you have in front of you. We'll help you figure out which one's right for you to say, hey, I've got this hospital in New York, you know, this exposure, this scale, this scope, what specifically goes wrong? What are the risks associated with that asset type in that location? And how do we match those problems with the solutions that we find out there, right? So that's why we started the Technology Alliance at NFP, to do exactly that. Figure out, okay, what's the asset? What's the exposure? What technologies are out there? And what are the best ones that will fit you to really help you?
I love that. Risk first, innovation second, right? And I guess that's true, because in your industry, like the whole point is to expose and mitigate and understand risk, whereas a lot of like the more stereotypical construction is like, how do we, you know, brush that stuff under the rug, even though we're supposed to be really good risk managers, right? So I think that is certainly helpful. And yet by starting with the risk first, I like that.
Like that's the low-hanging fruit for me. It's to say, hey, let's look at your losses and figure out what's going wrong. And and then match those problems with the solutions, I think. But risk management definitely needs to change. That's, like I said, the low-hanging fruit. What we need to do is start capturing way more data about what's going wrong with near misses, with incidences. It's not just about what gets claimed on the insurance side. So
I was about to ask, yeah, how do you know what the risks are, yeah, if they're not being measured, right? And so, moving from lagging indicators to leading, yeah, what are some areas where you guys are trying to do that on the risk front?
To figure out what the near misses and the incidences are,
I'm thinking like IoT or like other, you know, maybe ways of measuring advanced ways or, ahead of time so that we prevent it.
So holistically, I think we need to bring about four different pieces of the puzzle together. So there's your risk management information system, there's your project management system, there's reality capture, and IoT and the IoT backbone. Those are things that holistically come together to form this foundation of a decision-making tool, right? So you have your RMIS platform that collects everything that's going wrong, near misses, incidences, as well as managing claims. But that also is the exposure information that says, hey, I can tag it onto this project type to what's going wrong, what's going right, and what does my environment look like in any case, right, with the IoT data and the reality capture. So when something does go wrong and you fix it because you have a technology solution on in play, we need to start measuring, okay, what could have happened? How do I measure if I didn't actually solve this, what could potentially have gone wrong? And we learn a lot about risk and a lot about what goes wrong on project sites when we look at it that way.
There's a new FLA for you, Jeff, RMIS, Risk Management Information System. Because, I hadn't come across that before, but that makes perfect sense. And brought us here was at Procore Groundbreak, a project management system. What are some of the ways you're seeing are there any APIs or connections or ways that you're connecting a risk management information system with project management systems?
Yeah, we're going down that path and we're starting with just focusing on technology right now. So that's mainly my job. I talk to construction technology companies every single day, and we've outlined some of the top risk categories that we're seeing in construction. So everything from design, pre-construction, even into the ownership of the asset. And we figured out, okay, here are the top risks that we're seeing, whether it's fire, water, worker injury, right? The list goes on. But what we did was try to find the top companies, the top tech companies in each category to figure out, okay, now that we have this hospital in New York, how do we combine the right tech stack that will holistically solve all your problems, right? It's fun and easy with IoT because we can figure out how we manage risk just as human beings. We use our five senses, right? So if I put my hand on the hot stove, my fingers sense it's hot. My brain says, hey, take that off before it causes severe damage on your skin. We should look at the asset the same way and almost think of it like a living, breathing backbone, where if we have the right IoT in place, we can see what's going wrong, we can smell what's going wrong, we can feel what's going wrong, and all that information should feed into a single system, right? The risk management information system. And then you start tagging the information around, okay, with this project type, this risk information, this risk finance structure on the insurance side, this is what my total cost of risk will be.
So you hit on a lot there, but I'm going to do what Nathan did and roll you back a little bit, because I think when a lot of our listeners, especially because they're on the construction tech side listening in, or the VDC and BIM side, when we hear insurance, we just think of in case something happens. Mm-hmm. And as I've gone out into the world and learned more about what all the insurance groups are trying to do, especially, well, not all, there's always, you know, some that are going to lag behind, right? And every industry has their laggards, but you guys are trying to approach your clients differently as this trusted advisor. You said it yourself, which is a unique shift in how they look at you. And I'm wondering how that makes good business sense for you guys. And what the reception's been like, if, you know, they're listening in, why is it good to listen to you and listen to what you're trying to build for them and kind of advise them on?
I mean, we ran into this early on in my previous role where, like, things were behind, but we wanted to flip things on their head, right? I don't even like talking about insurance all day long. It's boring, but how can we change the conversation? Like, insurance has been around for a very long time and it's archaic, like you said. Construction is almost in the same game, right? So you take two very old archaic industries, how do you flip things on their head and change things up, especially the broker client relationship? We really wanted to be more consultant driven and get in the weeds with our clients and figure out, you know, Nathan, you say it all the time, shared pains, shared gains, right? So we want to figure out what is it that's giving you the pain in your business, and try to, like, hold your hand and walk you through this, because we don't see just one silo of information for one client, for one asset type. We see, as a broker, a whole global wealth of knowledge because it's a lot of different clients, a lot of different assets, a lot of different insurance companies, and a lot of information around what's going wrong. So we're not kind of blinded to just what you have in your lane. We can really expand that and figure out, okay, well, this particular claim or problem happened on this bridge in this location. That doesn't mean that you're never going to have that, but we know it's out there, right? So that's when we start to realize, how do we start measuring and monitoring those near misses, everything that can happen, everything that might happen when you have A, B, and C coming together, and how do you solve for that using those four core themes?
I like the four core themes too. I'm going to steal that one from you and use it a little bit, because I haven't seen them stitched together in such a good way to articulate to the industry how you use these things together. So what I'd like, you know, is maybe an idea here of, you know, where things are going wrong. And when you talk about having a risk system, a PM system, a reality capture system, an IoT system, they're feeding information, data somewhere. You know, what are you seeing go wrong, and what are you seeing go right when it comes to that data and that integration of flowing the information?
So the tricky part is those four themes of data. There's a ton of big data coming in from each system, right? So you could easily be drowning in data. The tricky part is to figure out, how do I boil down a million data points into the five most crucial points for each one, and figure out what data points are going to have the biggest impact on risk, on health and safety, and how do I tie those five data points together so I have a very small set of crucial information that I can monitor a project's critical path to success, right? So that's what we're going down the path and figuring out by line of business to say, hey, this is what we need for builders risk, for, you know, workers comp, for SDI. We're really trying to boil that down and almost have a very concentrated version of all of those systems that just say, hey, if you adhere to these five things, or if you follow these best practices, then you're going to have the biggest impact. Because they say, you know, 20 or when you have a problem, 80% is not that important. But if you focus on the 20%, then you're going to drive your results like crazy.
I love that, because it's the 80-20 rule. And yeah. There are so many people out there that are drowning in data. Mm-hmm. And they've been listening in and going, we need data. But now what do I do with it? So, I love that you have to boil it down you hit five things that, you know, you can focus on that can be bubbled to the surface.
That's the hardest part to do, I think, in all of this, right? That's where you need the true expertise in multiple different areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where that we get into that knowledge piece that you have, right? You're carrying mm-hmm. around the knowledge of a number of your different customers because you have exposure. And if I'm hearing you right, those five things aren't the same on every job.
No, they don't have to be. I think you need to really look at your exposure, what asset types you have, what's the scale and the scope.
So maybe I said that wrong. So maybe on every asset type, as you're building it, the five things you need to focus on, are they the same thing on all of the asset types, or are they five separate, but is it a different set each, not each time, but on each asset type? Is that how you're focusing it?
Yeah, I think it has to be different, and you have to kind of customize it every time you do this, right? So when you look at a bridge versus a road or a school, you're going to have very different risks. And what we're focused on doing right now at NFP is, by asset type, here are your top five risks that you're going to see, right? And mm-hmm. And then you start that journey of figuring out. But if you don't have the proper data architecture to begin with, then you're not going to get anywhere anyway. So having the right foundation, it doesn't really matter what that mix up or bespoke solution will be. If you have the right foundation, you'll be able to figure it out just using that.
I feel like part of this goes back to the, you know, Jeff, you always preach the zero sum mindset versus infinite mindset, and that, like, mm-hmm. if you're coming into risk management on a project in a zero sum mindset, it's about how do I either, you know, shed the things I'm worried about or manage the things I think I can capitalize. And like, it's a very transactional risk management as opposed to a project-based risk management where you're worried about safety, you're worried about things falling down, like you're actually worried about the true risks, not just the impact of those risks on your business. And like that, I feel like that's a total, you know, paradigm shift that this industry needs to go through. The clients that you're working with, are they the project owners where like at the end of the day, they just care about the project doing well? Or are they the individual companies where, again, the project doing well or the big being at risk, you know, may be relative to their exposure to said risk, right? They're two different situations. What do you find yourself in more often than not?
Yeah, we're working with both owners and GCs and some of the large sub trades out there. But when we're looking at risk, it is important to look at it from an enterprise level. But we find that the really tough part to figure out is the project specific level, because on the insurance side, you have your renewable enterprise policy, right? Everything that fits into a box will go under that policy. But when you're talking about these large mega projects, huge risk, huge exposure. If we figure out, you know, by asset type on those large projects, how to fix things that are going wrong, I think that'll have a bigger impact compared to just looking at your enterprise renewable policy. And it also has add-on effects, right? We've been talking a lot about technology, but we're also helping our clients figure out like risk mitigation from contractual operational best practices, as well as the risk mitigation. So those are three very different buckets, and we need different tools. So if you have different project delivery models, how is that going to affect your risk? If you have different operational best practices, how do you figure that out and make it match your risk profile? So it's really like those are the three themes that we need to kind of focus on to understand total cost of risk and also gain better understanding of how to improve it.
Yeah, it almost seems like the precursor to some of these, you know, more innovative insurance models that we're talking about, or insurance practices and ways of measuring those four things you're talking about, reality capture, IoT, like you almost have to be in an OSIP, owner controlled insurance policy, or a CSIP, you know, contractor controlled type of an environment. Like it's got to be really hard to do that in a traditional environment, or maybe I'm wrong.
Like we need everyone at the table. I think that's going to be key, right? Because we've got to have the proper contracts that enable innovation and success from everyone down the supply chain, everyone, downstream of that risk and that contract. And I think if we don't have that, then we're going to run into problems. I think that's probably been one of the biggest challenges and the biggest hurdles that we've seen with different contract types. I know in a utopian world, we'll have everyone, on like this IPD model that shares information and shares everything together. But as we know, that's very complex and very hard to do sometimes.
So I'm going to do a Nathan here and take you back, because we got some folks that you just lost. Nathan, you use CSIP and OSIP.
So I explained the acronym, though. It's better than Jonathan Marsh would do.
You just called Jonathan Marsh out.
I love you, buddy.
Give people a little bit of an idea, Chris, from the insurance side, you know, a little bit more about the CSIP and the OSIP and what you call the differences.
Yeah. So OSIP is the owner controlled insurance program. So that's when the owner procures the insurance policies, and the GCs and everyone below them will use that policy. And the CSIP is the contractor controlled insurance policy, where the contractor procures the insurance and manages the risk. So it's really, if the owner wants to manage the risk and take on the exposures and everything that goes along with that, they'll get the OSIP. But they can also say to the general contractors, I want you to take care of the risk, right? And figure out how you're going to manage the risk. And I don't think there's necessarily that many disadvantages and advantages of one or the other. It's just we still need to have both of those players at the same table to understand the risk more holistically. And I think they both need to have skin in the game to really help both sides win and come out on top.
And both of those are progressive models, you know, for at least, you know, in the last couple of decades. And I know the alternative to those two would be like you carry your own insurance, right? Like or bonded jobs or, you know, things like that. That, again, like we've tried to have roundtable conversations where we try and compare those two types of jobs, but they're so different that you really almost can't even compare them, right?
Yeah. And it all comes down to whether or not you have an OSIP or a CSIP, or whether it's bonded or not. It comes down to how are you getting the data around risk and how are you managing that, and not just doing that, but like you said, like how are you actually making a different decision next time, or a better decision, because you have the data? Because most people, they have all these systems, they're very disparate systems in silos. Maybe they have 16 different technologies that they're working with, but they've got 16 different screens up on their wall that they have to follow. They're not talking to each other. Mm-hmm. Just having the data isn't enough. even no. understanding the data isn't enough. It's what you do with that and how you actually change your behavior going forward.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to was that, okay, so you're doing all of this. How are you applying to that to decision-making and really driving better decisions? Because I think a lot of times the decision is a little bit counterintuitive because the data is finally telling us, hey, what your gut thought was wrong.
Yeah.
So how is this being leveraged, especially because you talked about you're managing risk throughout the project lifecycle? And I was really interested that you're talking about managing risk way up front in pre-construction, mm-hmm. forming the team. So how are you using this for teams to drive better decisions and inform them along the way?
So if you look at the life of the entire asset, right, I would say probably 70% of the cost of the asset is under the ownership and the operations of the asset. And mm-hmm. it's funny because the more you invest early on in the pre-construction, the less you can actually save in the maintenance and the cost of the asset. So it's bringing it all together.
Following on your point, Jeff, this idea of better decisions, anytime I hear the word better, I always kind of like put quotation marks around it because better is relative to what, right? And a lot of this, we've been talking about motivations, and that was part of my question about OSIP and CSIP, is that it creates a holistic project-based motivation to make better decisions, right? Because we can make better decisions in a more traditional insurance model, but that might not actually make the project better. It might make your company better. But if we're here to make the projects better, you know, I'm going to get up on my soapbox of, you know, more integrated project delivery models. But that's, I think, you know, to make better decisions, you have to be motivated by the right behaviors. And it all starts with, you know, tell me how I measure it and I'll tell you how I behave.
And I think we're starting to see, you know, some of the larger insurance companies have been doing a lot of studies and analysis around what goes wrong, what's going right, what data do we need. But we're seeing some of these MGAs pop up, like Shepherd and Insight Risk. And a lot of these are old tech guys, right, that were startup tech companies in the construction space that have shifted over to the insurance side and started up these MGAs because they realized if I just kind of boil down things to a very small concentrated set of data, I can figure out all I need to do now is measure the adherence to these best practices within each one of these techs. And that's how I get a better risk profile. That's how I make the project better, right? And I think it's up to GCs to figure out, you know, from project manager to the project manager, share these stories around, hey, I've had a really successful project on time, on budget, low risk. What did you do that went right? And how do you apply that to all of your other projects across your enterprise?
So if you can get that done, that's a huge move for the company and for the GC and for the teams as they move. Here's the big barrier we run into: cost.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right? Because you can't measure a mistake that you didn't make, right? That doesn't formulate into costs. So how are you tackling, because, you know, I'm out on the front lines working as, you know, in the software industry, trying to get, you know, tools in the hands of the industry itself. And consistently we hear about cost. So how are you guys approaching clients and really helping them and maybe even help, you know, you got a lot of listeners out there that you might be able to help with a strategy for getting these things paid for. So a project manager mm-hmm. digs this. But then they go, oh, well, if I go enterprise with that, it's going to cost me X. So how do you get past that?
So from my perspective, it's simple just to start with the losses on the insurance side, right? Because at the end of the day, when something goes wrong, you're paying for your insurance policy. The insurance company pays out the claim, hopefully, right? And that's a large portion of the risk that you're associated and seeing with the project. But what we're doing is, like, with this tech stack that we're saying, hey, here's three or four companies or five or six, whatever the case, that we feel is a bespoke solution for your project. Let's look at your past claims history and figure out if we restate your loss runs with this tech stack in play, and imagine if it was in place, how would you have lowered your frequency and severity of losses? Would this loss have happened? Would this loss have happened? You know, how would that have affected your claim going back 10, 20 years? Insurance companies are actuarial and science driven, right? When they look at data, they're using data from the past 20 years. A lot of the construction tech stuff is brand new, and we don't have that much data to prove out to them to say, hey, we're going to reduce your claims or losses by X, right? But in this simple way of saying, okay, let's assume this tech stack was in play for the past 10, 20 years, we take that story to the insurers and try to negotiate either paying for the technology, because we can say to a certain level of certainty, you can reduce your claims payments by 60%, because here's everything that we've analyzed and addressed with this proper tech stack, right? Specifically for this company. So they can either pay for the technology, which we're already starting to see happen out there with some of these MGAs, or they can reduce your insurance premium, deductible rates, premiums, things like that. And that is probably one of the biggest drivers for the cost solution out there going forward, because that's where the dollar kind of ends up lying with the insurance companies, right? When something goes wrong. So if we can pay a sliver of the cost or a fraction of the cost of, for the tech compared to your claims payout, then that's a no-brainer to me, right? So that's the path that we're going on, and that's what we're figuring out. So.
Well, and that's interesting you mentioned 20 years, because BIM has been kind of, quote-unquote, at least somewhat commercial mainstream for right around 20 years. So it will be interesting to see how much data is available in the industry for those actuarial scientists to say, does BIM save you money? Does BIM cost you money? Yeah. I mean, I think that question for those that are not in the BIM world is still out there, and we have to be able to find data that addresses that and puts that to sleep, right?
Yeah. And early on, it was really just about having the conversation of them taking a leap of faith to say, hey, this is what's out there. This is what it can do, matching problems with the solutions. But now we're starting to see they're doing their own studies, they're doing their own analysis, and they're starting to figure out, hey, if I use this water mitigation tech, I can save 60% of the claims I paid out, but it's only going to cost me, 10% to pay for the whole tech. So what would I do in that scenario, right? So.
Yeah, and this is a great conversation to have, because I know we've got a lot of the directors of innovation. We've got a lot of innovation folks that are listening into the show and pay a lot of attention, and they can get access to that data through you guys and through their insurance carriers. And we're always looking for that. I don't want to call it justification, but everybody's got to put a price on things. Mm-hmm. And yeah, a lot of those bills look really big in and of themselves when you're talking about licensing fees and you're talking about building a tech stack. It's not cheap. But comparatively speaking, now you're giving these folks an opportunity. So you're saying, listen, director of innovation, chief innovation officer, as you guys are going down this process of evaluating technology and evaluating technology stacks, get involved with your insurance carriers, get involved with the historical, the claims side of things to start to use that. Because we consistently hear a recent show I had with Dylan John, he talks about, return on implementation, because he's looking at it from a project manager perspective. But this gives you a global meeting, organizational globally view of an opportunity to apply this at scale and compare it to something where there is a chance to save money, right? If you're saving on those claims. It's a real unique piece for what's been really hard for a lot of the chief innovation officers, for a lot of the innovation folks to justify.
When you go down this path, you are going to kind of open up the door to what you're doing wrong and to what's going wrong. Not a lot of people are comfortable with doing that. They say if you're going to take your shirt off, you better be buff. So it kind of lends itself to that. But I think it's a whole culture shift, right? Because we're pressing down on the pain points in order to make them better. But it's going to be uncomfortable for a little while once we figure out what we need to do to get better. One of my favorite things to do is just analyze claims data, look for patterns. And then when something pops up, talking to a company and saying, hey, on the third day of every month, why do your claims spike? Let's drill down into that. Let's figure things out, right? And solve for that.
It's a great approach. Very hard. I like the, if you're going to take your shirt off, you have to be buff. It's like, no, actually, like we need to see the blemishes. We need to know that we're not in shape and we need to work out towards getting in shape. So you're saying it's construction and moment to take the before and after pictures. You got to have a before picture, right?
Yeah.
Well, and that's why I love the progressive snapshot analogy of, like, you know, what is your snapshot innovation? Because the business model that now I think virtually any auto insurance company follows is, whether it's your phone or whether you're plugging something in your car, you let it measure how you drive, how fast you go, how hard you brake. And if you fail, it doesn't cost you anything, but they still know that, and that's good. But if you're good, then you save money. And it's like, What is an insurance model like that that says, yes, let's be more transparent. Let's take our shirt off and show what's going on. And if you are as good as you say you are, here's your savings on your insurance premium. Mm-hmm. And if things are not as good, we're going to know to watch you more. But, you know, there's not necessarily a penalty, because if they were, they would never sign up for it in the first place, right?
Well, I think right now in the insurance space, we've been in a hard market for a few years now. I think almost everyone is getting penalized with high rates and high insurance, high deductibles. And what we're seeing is there's going to be a natural flight to excellence with companies that are going down this path already and fixing their problems and becoming better tomorrow. And those are the ones that are going to have the competitive advantage, right? To say to the insurance companies, hey, I'm actually doing something differently. And making sure I never have these risks appear going forward, because this is how I'm monitoring them, this is how I'm controlling them, or this is how I'm transferring them with insurance or risk finance, right? So there's a large group of companies doing that right now, and they're going to benefit on better coverage. Maybe the cost doesn't go down, but maybe they can save on their deductibles. Maybe they can save or have their tech paid for, right?
Yeah.
Until it's a point in time where...
Yeah, I think that the synergy, right? Like, if I'm a director of innovation or something, and I'm trying to pitch a new tech for IoT or something in the field that maybe I wasn't thinking about the insurance impacts before, but now I'm like, oh, wait, so I've got like a partial ROI calculation over here, and then I can add on this if we share the same data with our insurance provider, you know, we can maybe negotiate rates or deduct, like, just adding that into the conversation, I think will push a lot more of these innovations forward.
Yeah, for sure. And that's crucial to the cost, because it's a really solid answer to say, hey, how can I do this when it costs so much, right? Well, let's offset your insurance costs so you can pay for this.
Yeah.
And then that offsets the risk, which offsets the claims, which, you know, really in the end benefits everybody. Show me how I measure it and I'll show you how I act. And this is a benefit. Insurance companies are not making money by paying out claims, right? They're everybody in this is got their piece of the pie they need to make. And this is kind of leveling it out and at the same time helping everybody take a step forward. But I do like the idea that you're going to have to, you know, really get down and dirty that you're not doing a lot of things right. You do have a lot of risk. Where is that risk? Where are we going wrong? And then how can we fix it?
Yeah.
You know, it's counterintuitive for a lot of the people listening, but I hope we just gave a bunch of the folks that do listen an opportunity to go after another path, because man, that budget conversation, geez, I've been in the business 10 years and that budget conversation has been going on and doesn't seem to move much. So maybe we're finally starting to strike on some of the areas that they can move it forward. I'd like to pick your brain a little bit, Chris, since you do have that futuristic look and knowledge and where you're headed. What are some of the emerging techs that are really getting you going? Especially through that risk lens.
So actually, we've got this kind of cool video around the IoT backbone, this animated video that we're about to launch in the next couple of days. So I'll be sure to share that with you. But it's some of the cool tech that we're seeing out there. Excavation technology. They're putting sensors on buckets now to say, hey, as you're excavating and digging, you can live scan the ground below you to figure out, is something there? Should I go deeper? Should I stop right now and, you know, do an assessment? We're seeing a lot of cool stuff in the worker wearable space, where you have badges or things that you can wear in your hard hat that figure out where you are, who you are, how you're supposed to be doing things, how compliant are you, where you are within the vertical build of the building. And that kind of correlates with comparing the as built with the BIM model, right? The BIM 4D or 5D, and kind of merging this world of, you know, with reality capture, merging this world of augmented reality and real world situations, where you can almost build everything out on the computer screen figure out a lot of your problems, and then apply that even before you start putting a shovel into the ground, right? So I think it's this, all the texts that kind of come together that have open AIs that talk to each other that we can build out in this virtual environment and then make sure we have no problems going down after we really start construction.
Yeah, I like the excavation bucket I have seen as well. And I'm like, who knew, you know, 811 was something people wouldn't do and they don't do and they don't think about, or it washes away or whatever. Yeah. So here's an opportunity to get around that, which, man, I will tell you, even in the IT business, you know, I've got a lot of friends that do cable work, and, you know, I've got a buddy who was like, yeah, I've only ever used that once, but man, that insurance paid for it right there. And I wish I had something like that, cutting a fiber backbone, you know, it's just those kinds of things happen. So it's cool to see the technology that can impact and help out in the field. And then of course, virtually building's not going to eliminate every problem we experience in the field, but it's going to allow us to focus on just the problems that are unique to what we're doing at the moment when something goes, you know, not as expected is what I'd like to say. You know, because it's just not, right? Like, you're going to have a crane, you know, that's not operating for a day. You're going to have a piece of equipment that didn't, you're going to have a material issue, right? And how do you reorganize the team, and how do you prepare for those things? And can you see them sooner? Can you predict them happening? Mm-hmm. You know, so you can keep work moving, all those great things. So that's, I love it.
Changing, because I'm starting to see, you know, these videos pop up on YouTube and TikTok that, you know, have like, here's a crane that's falling over. Here's, you know, something that's going wrong on the construction site. And it's a shift in the demographics to the younger generation to say, hey, their problems are on construction sites. What can I do to help that? Because now they're starting to get exposure to this and starting to think about, okay, well, how can I fix this going forward, right? So we're seeing a whole new era of technology being developed now, which I think will come into fruition in the next 5 to 10 years. So it's exciting to see what's going to happen. So.
Ah, very excited about the future. That was a great segue, a nice little mic drop. We got to get into that construction news of the week. So thanks a lot, Chris, for the interview. Stick along. As you know, you listen into the show, so you know we're about to head into the news. And so, Nathan, what do you got for us this week?
I picked some just for Chris, so this will be fun. And those of you that don't know me, I was born in Boulder, Colorado. I went to school in Austin, keep Austin weird, and that was in San Francisco. So it's fair to say that I'm slightly left of center. But I think there's some really interesting stuff going on in California when it comes to emissions reduction and policies that may seem to be overburdening and very, you know, wasteful to the efforts that we do. I remember when working out in California, I had to report all of my travel costs and all the, you know, essentially the carbon waste that's created from your travel and lots of efforts that go into this. But I think what California is doing to implement new policies that are really going to, frankly, hurt companies like Chevron and Exxon and are being, you know, praised and supported by the Apples and the Microsofts and the Metas of the world. Because frankly, that stuff that as technology companies, they kind of already probably have systems that track that stuff pretty easily. So it isn't a huge, I think, operational cost for them to make those changes. But until we, you know, have more of these policies that go in place, I mean, Jeff, we were just at the CERT workshop that was focused on environmental social governance and this kind of intersection of, we all know we should do it and that it's the right thing to do, but until, you know, really the rubber meets the road and there's a business or a policy reason why we have to do it, it seems like we always seem to, you know, kick the can down the road. So I guess, Chris, I'm curious, you know, you come from the risk side, but certainly environmental data is another kind of like big thing. Are you seeing any overlaps between environmental measurements and risk measurements, or just any thoughts on kind of how these environmental measurements policies are changing construction?
Yeah, so I mean, I first started to see this really on you know, in Europe, where they were saying you can't procure this work unless you start measuring and figuring out carbon offsets and carbon use from not just yourself, but your whole supply chain all the way down, right? So it's no surprise that it's starting to come here in states like California, where, you know, we're starting to see big companies like Apple their latest commercial, sitting down with Mother Nature and talking about how carbon neutral their products are and everything, right? So I think it's just about corporate social responsibility, but also thinking about sustainability, because we're headed into uncertain waters going forward. If you're not going to be sustainable and start measuring these things, then maybe you're not going to survive, 10, 20 years down the line. So I think it's really important to look at this now, not just for what you can do for the environment or sustainability, but like even from a business perspective, can you survive in the next 10 years? If you don't start buttoning up it and start measuring carbon offsets and, how much are you sequestering your carbon and how you're affecting your supply chain down the road, because we're shifted into this completely new demographic that is shifting the values and shifting on how we provide value, right, to society. So.
And it's interesting, I forgot to mention, there's actually two different laws that were signed into law. So there's the Climate Corporate Data Accountability Act, what we were just talking about. And then the second law is this Climate Related Financial Risk Act, which is requiring companies greater than 500 million or more to report their financial risks related to climate change and their plans for risk mitigation, which it took me a while to sink in. I'm like, oh, wait, this isn't just about reducing your carbon emissions. It's actually looking at your own business and how will the impacts of climate change impact your own financial risk, and then how are you mitigating it? Like that kind of just blew my mind of a different way of thinking about the measurements, and that you can actually create policies around that.
And we're measuring capitalism in a different way going forward, because yes, there's financial risk when you're not looking at the sustainability and the future of your company. So.
Yeah, you hit a couple things there that I think is really hard for construction in general to get their heads around from a, 10 years. I mean, we've been talking about the labor issues for a long time, and they mirror this shift that's coming, and that the future consumer is going to look at all of this very differently. I think Apple and some of the others have seen that, they do work with the younger crowd, have a lot of data on that younger crowd. And you look at Meta and others, they know buying trends. They're seeing these predictors that I don't think construction necessarily has as much data on or understands as much about their buyer, because their buyer and builder is a little bit of the older generation still, and it hasn't fully shifted yet. The thing that I thought was interesting on this one, Nathan, that we experienced at CURT and I've experienced in a lot of other places is, a lot of times I see resistance to things. 10 years ago, I saw a lot of resistance to technology. And to be honest with you, I actually still see a lot of resistance to technology across the board. I'd say about 50% of construction companies are still pretty heavily resistant. 25% use it for real innovation, change, and moving forward. 25% use it for marketing and sales. I'm seeing on the ESG side of things, especially with carbon, there's less of a resistance and more of an openness to, okay, we get it, but how are we all measured correctly so that we can, on an even playing field, start to make these changes? Meaning, hey, if I choose carbon neutral materials, but then I choose, and have to account for the shipping, the supply chain portion, the usage down that line, if I'm doing that and my competitor is not doing that, their numbers are going to look better than mine. So how can I be measured in a fashion that's equal? And that's a cool conversation to hear owners and GCs and everyone have, because you don't hear like, oh, we don't want to do it. It's, hey, we want a level playing field so that we can all do it.
Yeah.
And that's very different. I don't see as much of the hesitance. I also see the experience. I'm starting to see the experience in data models, in standards. We talk a lot about standards, not usually a very fun conversation nor educated. And this time around, Nathan, it was very educated, very informed, and focused. So that to me is exciting, that in the not too distant future, we will actually be able to look at these built assets via a different thing other than cost, which will really help us drive change, right?
Yeah.
And that's been cool to see that there's a lot of that. So
absolutely.
Great article, buddy. What do you got next?
Moving on. Yeah. Speaking of decades, so you can see behind me, I've got my MetaQuest 2, and I just saw my accountant bug me that MetaQuest 3 has now been released. So I found this TechCrunch article and was just reading a little bit up on it. And, you know, certainly I think this year is a pivotal year for augmented reality and virtual reality. You saw the Apple Vision Pro coming out earlier this year, and there was the Quest Pro as well, which again is supposed to be built more for business, but I can't quite justify $1,000 for what is still seemingly just, you know, looking at BIM in VR, which, don't get me wrong, is extremely powerful and has helped us with many design decisions that would have taken much longer to come to. One thing I saw in here that was really interesting that I did not realize, so next March, it'll be 10 years since Meta/Facebook purchased Oculus, which I did not think it's been that long. It's crazy how fast it's gone. And just that the VR development cycle, like, you know, iPhones come out every year, right? But with the VR stuff, it's like about every 3 years, because sure enough, it was 2020 when I got my Oculus 2 when it just came out, and it's been 3 years. And now every time I put it on, it's a little slow, it's a little clunky. They're kind of doing that whole iPhone trick. I'm like, oh man, I'm gonna have to get the new one now. But it's up to $500 now, so I don't know if I can quite justify it yet. I'll see if it comes down. You gonna get one, Jeff?
You know, I'm actually watching this one a little bit from a different angle. Meta sort of took a step back watching Apple and what Apple came out with. And, I think they've been ahead. Zuck and them have been ahead, but I don't think it was driving in the direction they thought it would. And I think Apple did a little bit more of a calculated move. And I think Meta's on their heels watching this. So I'm interested in letting it sit for a little bit and really still seeing where is this thing going to play in. I know even my son, who was using it heavily, does not use it nearly as much, right? Hmm. Like, it goes through an ebb and a flow of where it's useful.
You can be too early to the party sometimes. And yeah. I think maybe Meta tended to do that, but Apple likes to sit back and watch it and refine technology. You know,
remember Google Glass? Yeah.
I do. And I think this is where this is going to be really powerful, because it's an arms race that happens now that Apple has jumped in. They're going to put the hammer down and we're going to see a chase. And I think we'll see some things we don't expect coming from them in use cases and usability. I think we're undervaluing what the usability is. I don't think we've hit on all of it. I mean, yes, walking through the model and visualizing things is a huge, powerful decision maker, right? And it helps people like me who can't really see 2D plans, see what's happening and experience things and walk through things. But it hasn't really crossed over completely, and I don't know when it will, but I think at some point it will.
It's funny that the article makes the exact same points that they use the term rising tide lifts all ships with Apple coming in. But that, it hasn't quite hit its iPhone or iPad moment yet, it's not quite there yet.
For construction, I think this really opens up the door for additional labor to come into the field that may not have ever thought about this, right? A career in construction. But now that you see, hey, I can have augmented reality glasses on the construction site that help me, you know, compare the as-built to the BIM. Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool stuff. And I think you're opening up the door to a lot of different people to get into this industry, which will help with the labor issues.
I'm still waiting for the trucking industry, to be honest. I think there's a huge one where this is going to happen, where kids are going to go to work in or at their office in their gaming chairs. I notice you have a gaming chair. I am using my daughter's gaming chair. It's a gaming chair that's fully equipped to drive a truck. They're going to throw that thing on, and the trucks are going to be driving themselves across the country on our highways, where it's very predictable and where all the sensors and things that we've created will work, and all of the cameras can show you every angle, and you're going to virtually pop into these trucks and drive them in a dangerous situation, or as you exit to get to a facility, things that we've proven don't work well for self-driving vehicles in those perspectives. And it would be kind of interesting too, to see if construction could do that, where, you know, that crane operator doesn't necessarily have to go to work, climb the crane and do all of that. I'm getting really out there, but they can actually just walk down into their living room, grab a cup of coffee, jump into the seat, throw the Meta on or throw on the new Apple Vision Pro, and they're in the crane and they're operating it.
No, I think we're so much closer to that world than we all realize.
I'm excited.
Remote piloted is way easier to do than fully autonomous. And I had never thought about that. That's a great point, Jeff.
I am excited for that one. I've been watching that and hoping that one comes because, you know, I could.
Let's go start a business. What are we doing on this podcast? Let's go start a business. Let's go do that.
Let's go start a business doing that. If you've ever seen me drive, I barely can drive a pickup truck. So no, just, trailers still get me. I don't know. So maybe not the right guy for it. I'm going to jump in because I've got an interesting one. And, you know, I love calling out our longtime friends. And this is a Rick Kahn article that he shared on the top 10 construction trends and innovations. And I kind of want to talk a little bit about what he had to say about it. He was trying to spark some talk, and they use this impact of top 10 construction industry trends and innovations, and they kind of charted it out, and still leading the charge at 19% is BIM. And I'm like, yeah, BIM really an innovation though? I mean, it's been around for 20 years. Is that really, you know, I don't know. It is still a trend. It is still getting into usage, but you know, it's going to be nice when it is a kind of a, I don't know, I don't want to call it a foregone conclusion, but there's a couple of things in here. And it's interesting because BIM, construction project management at 13%, are two things I don't consider innovative anymore.
No, when we're talking about innovative technology, I think we think of the future. What will the future look like? It's going to be so exciting. It's going to be so hard hitting. But then when we look around today, we realize that the future just kind of creeps up on you slowly. And sometimes what you thought was innovative just naturally worked its way into your daily business, right? And if you look back 30 years, they might think of this as, wow, this is amazing, flying cars, whatever the case, right? But to us, it's just so normal and natural. Just like what you were saying about BIM, it's been around for a while, but it's innovation that just became part of our daily operations now.
I'll push back on that real quick because I was just teaching an AGC project management class, and you know, it was about 25 project managers from most of the middle part of the US, and I asked how many folks are doing BIM on their job, and I got two hands. So, you know, we do live in our own echo chamber a little bit of, you know, we think things are mainstream when they're not. So we can do a whole other podcast on why that is. In fact, we probably will, but no time.
I think we've done a few over the years, but it's that 80-20. You don't have to model the whole thing, but but do the 20% where most of the risk is and where most of the value is, and please do it.
And who knows how many of those folks are on jobs where it is being done. They just don't see it. So that, you know, but that's still a project manager on the construction site should know if the job has BIM and should be leveraging it. So either way, it's an issue.
Yeah. And then I do want to highlight the big ones. Construction robotics hit, you know, second to BIM there, which, and then advanced building materials and offsite construction all took their spots at the lead here. And I think those are great trends to see. Because we need more and more. I mean, we just talked about ESG, and that's advanced building materials really solves a lot of those problems, but also then solves a lot of the labor problems, which is what offsite is focused on. Robotics, you know, still in our industry isn't necessarily focused on the labor shortage as much as it is quality, safety, and accuracy. Still, I think it will come around, as we've talked about with excavators and other things that in that robotics world that really hit there. But right now, I think they're augmenting our accuracy, which does help with the labor issue in the end, right? Because if you don't have to put walls in three times, you save labor and you save the need for it. So some cool trends there that I thought were great. And, you know, I was like highlighting something nice. There's a cool heart startup heat map to look at where a lot of these innovations are coming from, talks a lot about some of the companies that are doing it and emerging. So take a look. It's always fun to go in. My next one's going to be a little bit fun. And failure. We talked about this earlier about, you know, we've got to take our shirt off now and take our before picture and get rolling. It's how do Coca-Cola, Netflix, and Amazon learn from failure? So it's not just us. And I love it. You know, Coke was really bogged down over the fiasco of New Coke for years. And their CEO, James Quincy, is like, no, I want more new Coke moments. You know, if we're not doing those, we're not trying hard enough. And there was a consistent theme. Netflix CEO Reed Hastings saying, we have too many hit shows. Think about that for a second. We have too many hit shows. Like most places we're like, no, this is great. Be like, no, our hit ratio is too high. Means we're not taking enough risks. We're not pushing the envelope. We're staying safe. Mm. And, you know, we talked about this earlier. You have to be uncomfortable for change to happen. If my workout every day doesn't make me tired, doesn't stress my muscles, I'm not getting any better. Like, it was great. I saw a Kobe Bryant video recently about exhaustion and hard practices and him saying, yeah, I want to leave practice exhausted. Yeah, I want to be beat down, nothing left in the tank. How am I going to get any better? How am I going to be prepared for the game? So this is about pushing yourself beyond your comfort zone. If you are consistently comfortable, you are not growing. It's just kind of the mechanics of it. And the big ones are really, they're really focusing on it. Bezos is, you know, really pushing. If you're not taking bold bets and going for experiments, do it. They bought Whole Foods. That was a complete experiment. It hasn't proven to be what they wanted it to be. I think it will. And eventually they'll reach the goal they wanted. But this is some cool concepts. You know, Nathan, you're shaking your head. What are your thoughts on it?
I do think the whole, speaking of the Amazon and Whole Foods, is an interesting model, especially as I go to any Target or Walmart. Like they're different guys that come at it at different angles, but yet they're all realizing that the consumer, you know, wants to do everything in one place, and how do you serve them in a way that's efficient and builds that ecosystem? I mean, just underscoring how hard that is to do. That's an extreme, and that's what construction is, right? It's all these kind of disparate parts that you have to have come together at a quote efficient, you know, period of time. But how do you make all that work? And so I think, yeah, the fact that they're struggling with it, it's okay for us to struggle. And there are ways where, you know, the way that food service delivery is certainly, or not even food service, just grocery delivery is so different than delivering, you know, non-perishables. We can draw lessons from what they learned in their quote failure, even though they're seemingly such a different industry.
It's interesting. I learned early on in business school that it's really hard to be at the top. It's really hard to be number one because you do have this sense of comfort, right? And if you don't look over your shoulder, you know how hard those guys in two or three and all the way down are working just to catch up to you, right? So I think we almost have this false sense of reality or an understanding that large companies have it all figured out. But really, they don't. They have all of the same pain points and all of the same struggles that even the smallest guy has, right? And sometimes it takes that little pocket of a startup vibe or a startup mentality to figure out the big problems, even in the big companies, right? So it's no surprise that companies like Meta and Apple are taking on that kind of mindset and figuring things out in a smaller way to help the entire company. I think if you don't do that, you're not going to remain number one for very long.
Yeah, the innovator's dilemma, right? How do you continue to continually move forward in your space, but actually watch for that disruption and change in market and be on top of it? So it'll be interesting to watch. And the big ones fail. So if you're listening, you have to have an appetite and an environment for failure that supports growth and knowledge from that failure, right? Those are your learning moments. Those are your growth moments. But you also, you know, to come back around, we can't talk about failure and say you fail on projects. You have to fail in pockets. You have to manage that risk, manage that failure, and allow it to drive better decisions in the future without, you know, completely hurting the company either. We're not saying just leverage the farm and go take a risk and it doesn't matter. That would be bad business. So even for the small ones, but also for the small ones, you have just as many problems as the big ones, but you actually have a lot better opportunity to be flexible and fix those. And I think, we heard that in some recent episodes that have been out, from family business members doing things just to really take a chance to innovate, take a chance to fail, but also take a chance to succeed, because you never know, you might actually succeed.
Well said.
There you go. Well, that's how we're going to end it for today. Thank you so much, Chris, for popping in and joining the show today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Nathan.
Yeah, this was fun.
Yeah, Nathan, thanks for having you. Hi, Viz, so everybody can see you.
Off to the construction site now. Got to go do some inspections. Yep.
Safety first. Be out there and be safe, all right?
Thanks.
Thank you for tuning in today to Geek Out for our interview with Chris Green. To read all of our news stories, learn more about our guests, and to listen to the show, visit thecontactcrew.com. This is the Contact Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.